I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high and canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa.
Good evening, Vashon Island, and welcome to the Cats and Jammer Follies on Voice of Vashon, KVSH 101.9. I am your host, Megan Hastings, and today's show we are focusing on the great city of Los Angeles. Before Vashon, I had lived there for about 11 years, and here is part of my story that I spent while there in this fine, sunny town. In June of 1996, I had already been in Los Angeles for about a year and a half. I met a guy who invited me to a family party. His aunt owned the house and was notorious for throwing lavish parties in her mansion in the Homely Hills area of Beverly Hills. The house had once been owned by the Olympic skater Sonia Henning and was truly an inspired place to be, complete with murals of Sonia's homeland back in Europe. The first time I ever saw this house, I'm pretty sure I had never, ever been inside a mansion before in my life, let alone one with a massive pool and tennis court. The bar area inside the house spilled out into the yard and was full of June roses with the green of the grass so vibrant. The lawn was filled with all new beautiful faces drinking pink champagne. There were many familiar faces as well, as this aunt of his had been a B-movie star and singer in the 1960s and 70s. I passed a table where Shelley Winters was arguing with, I would later learn, her personal assistant over how many hamburgers she could have. Ms. Winters had piled her plate high, and then the assistant would take some away. It happened over and over again. I sat at the end of her table and literally ate it up. I ended up spending the next 7 years of my life with this family. They became my family there. This would be a true crash course in the way that life was really lived in Los Angeles. Although I had already been there for a while, I hadn't really seen this side of it. People can have such a derogatory tone when it comes to that city, and rightfully so, when there's so much wealth in your face. But I learned what was beyond that and left with real compassion for those who I had met and would spend time with, learning the complexities of tiered relationships from the housekeeper to the assistant and all of its pecking orders. This house was called Delfern, and from that day on, I never missed another party that was thrown there. But I also had many quiet days poolside with that pink champagne with the madam of the house. Her name was Connie Stevens, a name that I didn't know at that time, but would soon learn this woman was larger than life. From her ex-husband, Eddie Fisher, to her daughters, Jolie Fisher and Trisha Lee, to their half-sister, Carrie Fisher. They were all fiercely strong women, and I learned a lot from them. I was studying at an acting school there called Stella Adler during this time. The school is very small, but with an impressive alumni. On a monthly basis, they would have question and answers with alumni or anyone of note that would come through, Mark Ruffalo, Melanie Griffith, etc. I had asked Connie if she could come and do a talk with all the budding young actors, and she said yes. At this point, she was really known more for her cosmetic line and only really doing cameos on different shows, which I would often accompany her to. The day she came with me to Stella Adler, I remember driving down Sunset with the music on and she was singing, my own private show. She had a sweet voice that carried us all the way there. She was in all her element when it came to all things acting in Hollywood. She was a self-made person who built herself quite an empire, but she did like to share and share her knowledge as well. And I felt great about being the one who got to bring her to the table of that school. We heard about her brother John, who was one of the children in To Kill a Mockingbird, who would later die of AIDS in the 1980s. Her sister Ava, who was the producer on the classic Robbie Robinson's movie, The Band. And her time on different shows like Laugh-In and her hot song of the time, Kookie Kookie, Lend Me Your Comb. Her time with the 1950s crooner Eddie Fisher and her then rival Debbie Reynolds. If you are inclined to Hollywood history, it was beautiful to hear. And so many of those parties that we attended, a friend of mine and myself would find, we would seek out always the staff photographer and make sure we got our pictures taken with all the old timers like Milton Berle and Phyllis Diller. Some of these photos exist somewhere on the very first iMac computer I bought, which sits in storage. There's a photo of me and Phyllis Diller, and she was truly everything you could have imagined her to be, full of diamonds and laughter. We had Jolie's 30th birthday party on the tennis court. In the 90s, she had played Paige on the original Ellen show. Ellen was, of course, there, and so many younger actors, but I wasn't really interested in them so much as I was the older ones. They laughed better, with less insecurities, somehow just more regal. I often gravitated towards a woman who we called Auntie Frances. She had been Miles Davis's first wife and backup dancer. She was a small black woman with a raspy voice who liked to drink out of a flask slowly throughout the parties. She was from Chicago as well, so she and I always had lots to talk about. I became great friends with all of them. Stayed at Eddie's apartment in San Francisco. Wow, talk about an old charmer and a flirt. As the years went on, the parties got fewer and fewer, and so many of these people had died off, and Connie herself became older. And then my time would come to leave Los Angeles and begin a new life in the Pacific Northwest. I hear current tales of everyone occasionally, but nothing will ever recapture that time of youth and Hollywood combined. Whatever doesn't kill you will make you stronger, so the phrase goes.
Well now, let's take it from the top, grab some wheels. We're well along to talk about some cuckoo deals. Now you're on my wavelength, and I'm reading you just fine. Don't cut out of here till we get on cloud nine. I've got smog in my noggin ever since you made the scene.
Okay, and today we have more stories to tell about Los Angeles, and I have my dear friend Melody Woods here with us.
Hi, great to
Hello,
be here.
Hello, Melody. Melody is an Angeleno. She was not born and raised there, but she went there when you were like 11?
No, 13.
13.
Yeah, originally from Chicago, yeah. Like you. Yeah, and then my mother, who worked in the record business, got transferred to Los Angeles, so... Went from a small town in the Midwest to L.A., to the Hollywood Hills.
What aspect of music was your mom in?
Well, she was originally the secretary to Marshall Chess of Chess Records in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And then when Marshall Chess decided to sell Chess because he'd been offered the opportunity to move to London and start the Rolling Stones label, he asked my mother if she wanted to come with him. And I think my mother, who had, you know, maybe been to Wisconsin, you know, or, or Michigan. I mean, you know, you might have asked her to go to the moon at that point. And,
right.
You know, my sister and I were, you know, kind of young and my grandmother. And she was like, no, I'm not doing that. But in the end, he basically said, name your job. Tell me where you want to go. And she said, I want to go to California. I want to go to L.A. So
Aww.
That's how we ended up in L.A.
Wow. What a great story.
Yeah. So. So we moved to LA and we're in the Hollywood Hills, you know, in the early 70s with all the, you know, stuff that was going on there, part of the whole Ladies of the Canyon bit and everything.
So. I often dream about old time Los Angeles because I only got to see it. I guess the first time I ever went, I was like 17 and it was like in whatever, like 87 or something like that. But I often dream about a time when there really are orange groves.
Yeah.
In Orange County and like
right.
How beautiful it must have been.
And in North Hollywood.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, obviously that was long gone by the time that I moved there, but that's what it was, the whole valley, right? You know,
God.
Well, if you ever see the movie Chinatown, it gives you a real feel for what it was just over the hill.
Right.
Literally over the hill. It was just like San Fernando Valley with all orange groves.
I think LA Confidential does a pretty great job of capturing what an LA would be that would be ideal. Very different from it now, although I'm not bagging on it.
Yeah.
All right, Melody, will you tell us your story?
Well, yeah. So this is a story, as you know, Megan and I have talked about this before, because one of the things that you really need in Los Angeles is a car, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like cars really it. Like from the time that you're, you know, even thinking about when you can get a car, means freedom in Los Angeles. So we lived in the Hollywood Hills and there was no bus service to get anywhere. So you were really dependent on your parents to drive you around. Right. And when I was 16, that summer that I was 16, I got a job in this 16-track demo recording studio.
It was in Hollywood.
It was behind the Shawarma restaurant on Sunset and Vine, next to the Sunset Vine Tower. The guy who owned it was, a funny guy. His name was George Tobin, and he went on to have a certain amount of notoriety. And, you know, he produced kind of one-off albums. I don't think he ever produced more, with the exception of one artist. He later became famous, kind of his claim to fame, for discovering Tiffany, the 12-year-old, you know, shopping mall.
Oh, right.
The star, right? But other than that, you know, like he did an album
for... claim to fame.
Yeah, I mean, he produced an album for Smokey Robinson, and he did one for Kim Carnes and a couple other people. But in the 70s, he just had this little demo recording studio, 16-track recording studio. And I got a job there through connections of my mother, you know, so basically... you know, booking appointments, studio time, answering the phone, you know, opening the mail, logging the bills,
doing invoices.
What a 16-year-old could
do in that kind of a job. Yeah.
And, you know, my mother would take me to work every day and she or my stepdad would, you know, pick me up afterwards. But there were all sorts of crazy people that came through.
Was it a summer job?
It ended up going through my next school year or part of the school year at least, but I started in the summer. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And I had just turned 16. So anyway, it was, you know, and it was fun. It was easy. It was interesting. But you were
it
in this
great.
Dark, you know how recording studios are, right? This dark little hole in the wall behind the Shawarma restaurant on Sunset and Vine.
I've been in many recording studios in LA. My ex-boyfriend there was a musician. And it's such a weird thing because you're in the sunniest place ever. And then you're like, in these like dark, dank dark places.
Right.
And then you walk outside.
And of course at night, it was not really that particular area of Sunset and Vine was not a big, huge touristy area like it is now. It wasn't really developed. So, you know, it was like, my mother was like, wait until there were no cell phones then either. So it would be like, wait until this exact time to walk out to the street, you know, to get in the car, you know.
Was it a little bit rough?
It was a little bit rough after dark. It was late. And in the summertime, I actually like would work later because everybody came in at night. Nobody recorded in the daytime, hardly. Musicians all worked at night.
Well,
right?
You got to have drinks.
Yeah, I didn't even start until like noon, right? You know,
that's
it was
a good
like,
time.
No, I guess nobody even called musicians before noon, but.
That makes sense. Very telling.
Shortly. So, you know, I had my driver's license, but, you know, we had two cars in the family, but my parents really didn't want me to drive at night at that point. Mm-hmm. So I rarely could take the car to go to work. I was really dependent. So I was like, you know, kind of really determined that I was going to get a job that paid decently so I could earn money to get a car. And that was the whole reason why I took this job, because it paid more money than any place else that I could find. Right. So George was a really interesting character. He didn't usually even come into the studio until about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. He would call maybe once or twice, but otherwise I was there. I opened up, I took the things. And
that's a lot of responsibility for a young
person. I know, right? But it was fun. I liked it. Most of the time I was there by myself and I would just play music and, you know, so it was great. And here I am 16 in this little recording studio and various musicians come in.
So was he like the whole kit and caboodle, like producer, soundboard guy?
Well,
like...
that's what he was working towards. He had another sound engineer that worked with him. And a lot of times these artists would come in and they would bring me even their own sound engineer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was literally like a facility for hire, right?
Got it.
So it was set up. So one day he comes in the afternoon a little earlier than usual, and he's in his office for a while, and he comes out to the reception area and he hands me, you know, everything was recorded on 2-inch magnetic tape you know, back in the day. So he hands me what's a big square master box of 2-inch tape, hands me this box, and he said, I need you to take this and deliver this master, and but you have to get payment for it. You know, don't give them the master. It's a COD payment. And that was the rules. You didn't get the master until you like paid for your session. And so I said, well, how am I going to do that? Occasionally I would have like my mom's car or something, but not very often. And I said, well, my mom dropped me off. And he goes, oh, here, you know, you can take my car. And he hands me the keys to his like brand new Bentley.
Oh God.
I mean, this is one of those big, huge ass Bentleys. Oops, sorry. One of these big, huge Bentley sedans. I mean, literally, I think it must have been 3 months old. Now, mind you, I'd only had my driver's license for a month, I think, at this point.
Oh, right? God, that sounds so stressful.
So he hands me the keys to his Bentley, and he gives me the address. And in those days, you didn't have GPS. You had to look in the Thomas Brothers guide to find out where it was. And so I'm looking it up and hadn't kind of been in this part of L.A. before. And I'm like, oh, okay, whatever. And I kind of write down the directions and get in, here I am, little Miss 16-year-old in my mini skirt and platform heels and my, you know, long blonde hair, and take this tape and get in the car.
I'm sure you're so beautiful.
Driving in the Bentley and find this house, you know, park, go walk up to the door, knock on the door, and I've got this tape, and this woman comes to the door and answers the door. It's a woman. She's black. She's got really, you know, kind of short hair. And I said, I've got a package to deliver from George Tobin, and I need to receive the payment for it. I'm to pick up the payment in exchange. So the woman turns around and she yells, she goes, Ike, George's messenger is here. And so I'm looking at this woman and she says, Ike, and I'm looking at this woman. I'm remembering Ike. And then Ike starts coming to the door and I go, holy Moses, that is Tina Turner.
Oh my.
So it was Tina Turner. So I'm now like, you know, I'm delivering this tape to Tina Turner. And so Ike comes to the door and Ike is all like decked out. I mean, she was really kind of like playing with, you know, house slippers on and whatever, right?
But right.
He comes to the door and he's all like in his fancy satin shirt or whatever and his shiny shoes. And so I go, oh, Mr. Turner, nice to meet you. Because he goes, and so I hold out the box. I said, you know, George says, you know, you're going to give me the payment for this. And he's got this envelope in his hand. So he puts one hand on the box and I put one hand on the envelope. And then I let go of the box and he keeps holding on to the envelope. And then he's looking at me and I'm looking at him and I'm thinking, okay. And then he goes, tell George I like his messenger. Right. I go, okay, we'll do. And like take the envelope and turn, like, you know, yeah, get in the car, start driving back. And then all of a sudden I'm thinking, this is a really kind of fat envelope. And that box seemed kind of light. And then I remember that, you know, at the time, Ike Turner was famous for, you know, like doing enormous quantities of drugs and cocaine and whatever. And then I thought, holy shit, because I had seen George before, like, you know, give musicians pot and pills and stuff like that in the studio or whatever. All of a sudden I thought, he just had me deliver drugs to Ike Turner. So the whole drive back, I'm fuming because I'm like, oh my God, this guy had a 16-year-old, a minor, deliver drugs.
I know. What if he would have gotten caught with that?
To Ike Turner. I just delivered drugs to Ike Turner. That's crazy.
Oh my God, Melody.
So by the time I get back, because it's like a, you know, half hour, 40-minute drive away, by the time I get back and I go like stomping in on my platform shoes and like, you know, tossing my head back and forth and like wagging my finger at him, and I said, I know what was in there. That was not tape. That was like drugs. You had me deliver drugs to Ike Turner. And I've got this envelope that I'm like waving at him while I'm talking madly. And he's kind of like, you know, looking at the envelope, not at me. He's looking at me waving the big fat envelope of money. And I go, like, how would you do that? You know, you could, that's like a felony. I didn't even know. I just said, that's like a felony. He goes, well, they couldn't do anything to you. You're a minor. And, you know, they wouldn't open it if they stopped you, right?
You
they
were his open pawn.
Right.
Oh,
so I said, that's ridiculous. That's criminal. I said, don't you ever, I am never, ever doing that again. And if you don't give me a raise, I'm going to tell my mother. And that's how I bought my first car.
That is so good. That is the best ever first car story. I don't think anyone can ever top that. What an outrageous... Melody, that is for sure one of the best LA stories I think that I can ever come up with. The true stories of LA are so much better than the movie stories of
LA.
They
definitely are. Yeah.
Can you tell us what kind of car you ended up buying?
Yes, I ended up buying a 1965 Mustang convertible.
What
faded,
color?
Faded red, and but with the original, you know, white leather interior for $500. So yeah.
Oh, God. I also drove a. I drove a 1969, not convertible, but Ford Mustang.
Yeah.
With the long nose. It was my first car that I ever bought in LA. And I drove it for a good 6 years till I drove it into the ground.
Yeah. Mine was, I loved that car, but it was always breaking down. I mean, it was always overheating. I was always getting stuck places with it. And then one New Year's Eve, somebody slit the convertible roof and it got flooded inside. And I think, if I remember correctly, I ended up selling it to my, you know, kind of to my poor beleaguered mechanic for $500, the same thing that I originally bought it for.
And I bet he totally redid it.
He totally fixed it up. I mean, I saw it like 6 months later and it looked like, you know, amazing. Now, of course, I wish I had that car, but
so
not quite the Bentley, but
Well, those Bentleys. I remember, just to go back to my story, just for one second, just on the car thing, I would often do a lot of errands for Connie, and she had a brand new Jaguar. This would have been like, I don't know, 2000 or something, but like really big and fancy. And I was just like, I remember having to drive it to downtown, and I was just like, oh my God, it would be so stressful to drive someone's like brand new gazillion dollar car.
I think I was too young to be stressed out about it. I mean, part of me was like shocked that he would give like the keys to somebody who'd been like, you know, had a license for about a month. But on the other hand, I was
Well, clearly, you know, he didn't care.
Bentley, here we are.
Yeah, he had to get Ike his
about,
goods.
You know, talking about ballers, right? I mean, LA, so right.
Total baller. And so did you ever end up telling your mom?
Yes, I did. It was probably, I don't know, maybe 15 years later or something, because we had read some article about, he went on, George Tobin, he went on, obviously he was kind of low rent record producer slash drug dealer. But then he went on to build like a big 16, like kind of a recording studio complex in North Hollywood. And it was really well known for doing demo work and everything. So he kind of, I don't know how long he stayed in the drug dealing business, but.
Well, it might actually be more lucrative than.
Yeah.
But
that obviously, was how the rent was being paid, you know, in those early days of his career. So
How old was he compared to you? I mean,
I think at the time he must have been in his early 30s.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't that old. I mean, he seemed old to me because I was 16. But I mean, I think that's probably about how old he was. I mean, he was married and had two really young kids. So
got it.
Wasn't like he was a sleazy guy. He was actually a really nice, personal
guy,
right?
I'm sure.
I mean, you
it's
know,
part
he
of
didn't
the culture.
He didn't act sleazy, right?
Yeah.
You know, but
again, it is part of that culture. Yeah.
But that is a pretty sleazy move, sending a 16-year-old to deliver drugs, right?
Yeah, I would say so. It's not something I would do. Wait, I had one more question. Is the recording studio that he put together in North Hollywood, is that still around? I mean, how long did you work for
I don't know, because I didn't work at that. I worked for less than a year. Like I worked that summer and then probably a few months into the school year. Definitely I worked at least a couple months into the school year, because I remember funny stories when I had like, you know, just negotiating school and the work. And I had a curfew of what time I had to be home. And
who else would you have met through that studio? Anybody of note?
Yeah.
Not dealing drugs, too, though.
Not dealing drugs. I never dealt drugs to anybody, you know, delivered drugs to anybody after at that. But yeah, Barry White, he and I fell in love over the phone for many weeks because he kept setting up demo studio recording time and then kind of canceling. But I didn't really know who he was, but his voice was just so
magical,
sexy on the phone that it was like, oh, hi, Barry, right? Whenever he'd call. And then it was funny because the first time he came in, of course, he didn't look like, you know, in my mind, he was kind of, you know, like, I don't know, you know, Denzel Washington or some, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Hot, hunky guy. And then, you know, the walrus of love walks in, right?
That's a great term for him.
The walrus of love.
I like that.
But he was very nice, but he was really funny. But he had that voice and he knew it. He was like a big old flirt with that. With that sexy voice.
Yeah, I can imagine. Melody, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for
having me.
It's always a great time reminiscing with you about our shared experiences in various cities.
Oh, I know. I love it. I hope all you listeners out there have a good laugh over our expense, mostly Melody's. Not really mine. Thank you again, Melody.
All right. See you soon.
Hate New York City. It's cold and it's damp, and all the people dressed like monkeys. Let's leave Chicago to the Eskimo. That town's a little bit too rugged for you and me.
For tuning in, this is Megan Hastings, and this is the Cats and Jammer Follies. See you next week with another city or country or place. Who knows where we're going to go? Have a great week.
We love it.